haven't done anything yet. Okay, so start off, I'm going to introduce you to Alice and Bob. Alice and Bob are actually, they live quite far apart and they like to actually talk to each other. And obviously they can't sort of kind of get together directly because, you know, they're too far apart. But they have got internet connections. And of course they like to use this newfangled internet thing to talk to each other, maybe make a voice over IP call, or maybe play a game together. So, you know, ideally it'd be pretty simple, and you just create a direct connection between them. Using this internet thing, you create a connection from Alice to Bob, and they can exchange data. It's a bit more complicated than that, because we have these IP addresses, and if Alice wants to talk to Bob, she might not know what Bob's IP address is. So what we do is we might use a server, and then you know the server's address. You connect to the server and you say, okay, I want to talk to Bob, and the server will forward packets between you. Pretty simple. You might use different protocols for this. So you might use SIP, which is a fairly common voice over IP protocol. Or you might use Jabber, which is used for chat, but also has voice over IP capabilities these days. Pretty simple. The problem is that Clive, who runs the server, is pretty unhappy because suddenly all these people are using his server and his bandwidth bill is huge. And, you know, especially Australians, you know, bandwidth is very expensive and things are generally pretty slow. So Clive started the server and suddenly, you know, he's having to pay a lot of money, which is not so great, really. So how do you get around this? Of course, it might be possible that, you know, I can go through multiple servers. This is pretty common with Jabber, where Alice and Bob might have accounts on different servers, and then the servers will talk to each other. So if you're making a voice call, you might have loads of data going between them. So what the solution is to split what we call the signaling path from the media path. And all this means is that you exchange metadata about the communication you're making through the server, which is pretty small. And then the actual data yourself, you send it directly between you. So for example, for a voice call, the media data would be RTP, containing encoded voice packets. So if you're using Speaks, you'd encode the audio data from your sound card, from your microphone as Speaks, and then you'd encapsulate that in RTP packets and send it directly. And then the metadata would be things like, I want to call you, and they say, okay, you can call me, and okay, I want to hang up now, and things like that. The problem we have is that sending the media directly gets into trouble as soon as you have what's called a NAT, which is a network address translator. And network address translators are pretty common in home networks, also corporate networks. And the reason we have them is that there's a scarcity of IPv4 addresses. Although there's 4 billion IPv4 addresses, there's inefficiencies in the way that they're allocated, and so people tend to get allocated fewer IP addresses than they have machines. And the way we work around this is by having a network address translator, which allows you to have one IP address that's shared between multiple computers. And what the network address translator does is, when you send packets out of your network, it modifies the source address. So if I'm sending a packet out from my computer through a network address translator to the internet, then when the packet goes out, the NAT will rewrite the source address. So it looks like I'm coming from the address of the external NAT rather than my internal address. I'll go through this in a bit more detail. So I'm one of these computers here. I want to talk to people on the internet. And inside the NAT, there's a table. And this table maps connections on the inside to connections on the outside. So it will have two interfaces. And the internal interface will have what's called a private address range. So in this case, 192.168. address. And then on the outside, it will have a publicly routable IP address, so one that other hosts on the internet can talk to. Hosts on the inside of the network will have addresses on the same network as the internal interface of the net. And then when, if I'm 192.168.0.2, I want to connect to some host on the internet, then when I do that, it will create an entry in its table with the address and port that I'm coming from, and it will allocate a port on its external interface, which will be used for traffic coming back in. So I'm sending out a packet on port 234, and then when it sends packets out from that connection, they go out in port 456. And when packets come in, it looks up the incoming address on its table. So if a packet is addressed to port 1234, port 456, it will then know to send it to my computer rather than any of the other computers on the network. The problem with this is that if a packet comes in and it doesn't match any of these mappings, it's just going to drop it because it doesn't know what to do with it. And what this means is you can't make incoming connections to computers behind that. So in the case where we have, if Alice is behind on that and Bob isn't, this is fine because Alice can make a connection out and then we've established a connection and then Bob can send packets back to Alice. But if Bob wants to make a connection to Alice, it doesn't work because the NAT doesn't have a mapping for that connection. And if Alice and Bob are both behind the NAT, then they can't initiate connections to each other and you can't talk. So the way we work around this is, this is a bit complicated, so bear with me, is that we use a technique called NAT punching. What this does is create a hole through the NAT where otherwise we wouldn't be able to. So this relies on having external servers. We can't just have Alice and Bob. We need to have some people who will help us make a hole through the NAT. I use something called the stun server, which is pretty simple. And we start off, Alice sends a packet to the stun server and says, "Hi, what address am I actually coming from?" So Alice, when she starts off, she doesn't know what public IP address the NAT will give her. So you send a packet to the stun server, and it says, "Okay, you're coming from. Looks to me like you're coming from this address, 1234." And it tells Alice this. So Alice now knows what it looks like she's coming from. She then uses the signaling server. So it might be a SIP server or a Jabber server to tell Bob what address she's coming from, and then Bob can then use that address to sign 10 packets to her. And then in parallel, Bob will also be doing the same thing. So Bob will ask the Sun server, maybe the same one, maybe a different one, what his external address is. And once it's found out what his address is, he'll tell Alice. And then Alice will also try and make connections back to Bob. And you hope that, you know, if you do this enough, then you'll create mappings from Bob to Alice and from Alice to Bob, and you end up with a connection which can send packets in both directions. It's a bit magic, and it works in most cases, except for when what you have what's called a symmetric NAT. I'll get onto that in a bit. But this also works even if you've got multiple layers of NATs, which is not so common perhaps in many countries, but in countries where the IT infrastructure is less well developed, then you might find that people are chaining internet connections and you have complicated setups with multiple NATs, especially in developing countries. But in theory, this can work fine with that because you punch through all the layers of NAT at the same time, just as long as the Sun server is outside the outermost layer of NAT, because otherwise it will think you're coming from an IP address that Bob can't actually see. So if we can do this, then everybody's happy. Alice and Bob can talk to each other, and Clive and Debbie, who are running these servers, their bandwidth bills are much reduced. Problem is when we get to symmetric NATs, and these are different to other NATs in that when they create a mapping, they include not only the internal address of Alice's computer and the external port that it's mapped, but also the destination address that Alice is sending packets to, which means that if packets come back from a different address, so if you go back to this case, we initially send a packet to the Stun server, then Bob starts sending packets to that same address, then it will drop them because they're coming from a different address to before. And this works fine as long as only one of them is symmetric, because then you can start a connection and then... This is where it gets quite hairy. It works if Alice and Nat is symmetric and Bob's isn't, because Bob's will create a mapping and then Alice can connect to it. But if both of them are symmetric, then it breaks. But in that case, you have to fall back and use a relay, which is unfortunate. But in most cases, you can get through and trick them out. So lots of people had a go at approaching this problem. And I'll go through the kinds of various kinds of solutions that people have made. So two protocols which Microsoft and Apple have come up with respectively are UPnP Integrated Device, which is part of Microsoft's suite of UPnP protocols, which use XML and generally quite complicated, in my opinion. And Apple have come up with something simpler called NatPnP, which is simpler, but they basically do the same thing. And the idea is that you talk to your router, which is doing the network address translation for you, and you say, hi, can you open up this port for me so that I can talk to Bob? So the idea is Alice talks to the router and says, hi, can you open an address for me? The router says, okay, I've opened up this port. Alice then tells Bob what that port is, and then Bob can send packets to it. The problem with this is that it actually requires support from the router, and most routers don't support these protocols. And if they support one, they don't support the other. So it's quite hard to say, well, you should use one, you should use this protocol, that protocol, because in most cases, router doesn't support whichever one you're using. Or you can use both, then you still haven't got a great chance of having something that works. The next two, Teredo and IEA, these are aimed at providing IPv6 connectivity to hosts behind NATs. So first of all, it assumes that you've already upgraded to IPv6 and you're IPv6 ready, which of course in an ideal world you are, but not everybody is ready to make that change. So it's a bit unfortunate for that. Realm-specific IP is, I don't understand too well, but as I understand it, it involves relaying packets. So that again sends bandwidth costs up, so that's out. The Media Gateway Control Protocol is not actually a protocol. It's sort of a hypothetical protocol, which this working group in IETF has been working on. And they've come up with some requirements for it, and some RFCs with requirements for the protocol, but no actual protocol as yet. And Middlebox Communication is the group inside the IETF that's working on that. And then there's application level gateways, and the idea is that you buy from Cisco or Newport Networks or one of these companies a router which understands these high-level protocols. So it understands SIP, and it looks at the SIP requests as they're going through and says, oh look, it's talking about this port here. And then it can sort of be clever and open ports when automatically for you. Problem again is that you need to replace your router, so this is you know more complicated than we want it to be. And finally it's done, which is the protocol that we were using before to find out what are our external addresses. And Stun in itself is good. It lets you do this hole punching trick. But it's pretty simple and it has problems. It doesn't account for problems like some security problems that we've got and it doesn't work in all cases. So Stun is pretty simple, it's just a request response protocol. There's an RFC which basically gives you a protocol for working out which kind of NATs you're behind, which is not particularly useful because you know you can say, okay, am I behind this kind of NAT? It doesn't really help you because it doesn't. If even if you know what kind of NAT you're behind, that doesn't really help you escape from behind that NAT. There's a revision of it which makes it into a more sort of general protocol where you can have different applications of Stun. So you can do things like find out your external address and also set it up for relaying as well. So you can use the same protocol for finding your address, and then if you can't punch through the NAT, you can use STUN for setting up a relay as a fallback. So STUN is nice, but it's not the whole picture, and what I'm going to talk about as the silver bullets to escaping hostile networks is ICE. ICE is it's a draft IETF protocol. It actually went through a lot of revisions, but I think just a few weeks ago it got submitted to the RFC editor queue. What this means is that there's no more revisions until the RFC editor looks at it. And if they're happy, then it becomes an actual RFC, so we'll have a real standard for doing this. And LANCE pretty much boils down to generating candidates, and a candidate is an address, essentially. So the address might be the local interface address. So in Alice's case, it was 192.168.0.2. Or you might try and find out, you know, my external address is 1234, or you might get another address by talking NATPMP to your router, or UPnP ITD to your router. So the idea is that you can connect these different addresses and try them all. So the nice thing about it is it can incorporate these other protocols. So you can use STUN, you can use UPnP, you can use NATPMP, and get lots of possibilities for making the hole punching work. And you can try them all and use the best one. And the idea is that you connect your candidates, you tell each other what all the addresses that might work, and then you send what's called connectivity checks between them. And a connectivity check is pretty simple. It's just kind of, it's actually the same thing as we talking to the STUN server earlier. So you send a request out saying, hi, I'm Alice, Bob, can you hear me? Bob says, hi, yeah, I can see you, and you're at this address. So in addition to sending some requests out to the server, Alice and Bob send requests out to each other. This has some nice properties, like you can authenticate. So the connectivity check includes authentication, so you can make sure it's not somebody else that's trying to talk to you. You exchange the authentication through the signaling protocol. So you say so Alice would say via SIP to Bob, I've got this address. If you talk to me on this address, use this password. So when Alice gets a connectivity check, she can verify it's actually coming from Bob and not from somebody else who's trying to hijack the voice over IP connection, which is something that just using basic STUN doesn't give you. And this also helps you find out when a connection goes down. So you might time out the connectivity check, and if you don't get a response back within that timeout, then you know that link is broken. And the nice thing is, because you have multiple candidates, you can then switch back to using a different candidate. So maybe one network link's gone down, but you can use a different one. So an example might be that you're connected to the wireless, but then you want to make a fast file transfer from your hard disk on the network. So you switch to using a wired connection, and the voice call you're making should carry on going, because it will just detect, the wireless connection's not working, I'll use this wired connection instead. So the other part of that is that while you're doing the voice call, you're continuously looking for new candidates as well. So when the wired cable gets plugged in, you say, oh, I've got a new address. And you tell Bob, and Bob can try using it. So this is actually, I'm not expecting to actually look at the details of this, but the way we encode this into what's called SDP, which is what's called the session description protocol, which SIP uses for making voice calls, is that we encode these candidates into the request when you make an offer or an answer. And similarly for Jabber, Jabber has an extension called Jingle for making voice over IP calls. It has multiple transports, and one of the transports you can use is ICE. When you use that transport, you encode your candidates as XML, and you send those over the Java connection. One of the other nice properties of ICE is that it upgrades nicely to IPv6. So if you have an IPv6 connection, then you'll gather an IPv6 address. And you just tell Bob, I have this IPv6 address, and if Bob has IPv6, then he can talk to you. So this means that if you upgrade your network to IPv6, then you don't have to make any changes to the way you're using voice over IP. So it's nicely feature-proof in that way. VoiceHammer is an interesting attack on voice over IP. And let's say I'm Eve, and I want to I don't like Alice for some reason. So what I'll do is I'll pretend to be Bob, and I'll send a call to Alice. I got it wrong. So I'm Eve, and I want to trick Bob into sending packets to Alice. So I call Alice, and I give her Bob's IP address. So Alice will start sending packets to Bob, even though Bob hasn't requested a voice over IP call. And you can do this lots of times, and then your internet connection is saturated with VoIP traffic that doesn't have any reason to be there. And the way ICE protects against this is by using the authentication inside the connectivity check, which again, this is something that using Stun alone doesn't give you. So people have been using Stun in a kind of ad hoc way for punching through networks, and ICE standardizes all these techniques to give you something which has been tested and should work in most cases. So getting down to concrete implementations, the one I've been working on is called LibNice. And I started this January last year, just after LCA. And I sort of wrote a very basic implementation of the draft standard at the time. And then I just left it for several months. And I was thinking I'd come back to it at some point, but sort of didn't get around to it because, of course, other things intervened. And then these two guys at Nokia, Kai and Remy, told me that they've been doing lots of work on this code that I've released. And they actually sort of made it for support the full standard, updated it to the latest version of the standard, did some really great work, and actually wrote most of the code. So I'm actually sort of a bit of a cheat, because I sort of wrote a bit of code and everybody else finished it. But I guess that's how free software works.
Just out of interest, how did they discover it? Had you announced it on mailing lists?
No, I didn't really make a big noise about it. I knew them through other stuff we'd done. We worked with Nokia on the internet tablets. So the internet tablets have a capability to do voice over IP calls using Java. And so we sort of knew them through that stuff. So sort of knew that I'd be working on it, and they were interested, and then they decided to pick it up. So Farsight is a library for doing voice and video calls with GStreamer. If you're not familiar with GStreamer, then it's a library for setting up pipelines of media processing. So you have a diagram. So the idea is that you have source elements which generate data, and sync elements which consume data, and then you chain together pipelines of elements. And so in this case, a simple example would be that you have audio coming from the sound card, and then you encode that as MP3, and then you save it to a file. So you have maybe an ELSA source, a MP3 encoder, and then a file sync. For doing voice call, this is actually a bit simplified, because Farsight does actually really complicated pipelines with loads of elements in them. But essentially, when we're doing voice over IP, we create GStreamer pipelines which generate audio from the network, demux the RTP, so RTP can contain multiple streams, and we extract one stream, put it through a jitter buffer so that any network delays get smoothed out. Then we what we call depayloading. And what this means is that for every kind of codec we might use, So for instance, you might be using Speaks, or you might be using G711, or you might be using other voice codecs. And for video, you might be using Fiora, or you might be using H.263, one of these other codecs. And each codec has a different way of encoding it into RTP. So depending on the codec you're using, you need to encapsulate it into RTP packets in a different way. So in this case, in this example, we're using Speaks. So after the data buffer, we depayload the Speaks data, we decode it into raw audio data, and then we play it, for instance, in ELSA. And then for sending, we do something similar. So the ELSA source gives us the raw sound data, we encode it as Speaks, we payload it into RTP packets, we multiplex it into an RTP stream, and then we send it over the network. So the idea is that the nice source element and the nice sync element look like a simple network element. So in a simpler setup, you might be using just a UDP source and UDP sync, and you'd hard code the IP address and the port. And the idea is to make the nice source and the nice sync behave like that and hide the details of all the nasty match punching and connection setup. Telepathy is a abstraction for voice over IP. So in the same way that the X abstracts access to your display hardware and input devices, telepathy abstracts access to your instant messaging accounts. So the idea is that multiple programs can send and receive text messages or make and receive voice calls. And telepathy sort of hides details of that in the same way that the X server hides details of your display hardware. And when we make voice calls, we generally have two processes. So there's one process which is the connection manager, and it might be for an XMVP connection you'd be using the connection manager we call telepathy gabble. For a SIP connection you'd be using the Sophia SIP connection manager. This talks to a separate process called Stream Engine over Dbus. And so the idea is that very much like how you separate the signaling from the media on the network, then the connection manager doesn't need to understand the details of all the RTP, doesn't need to talk to the sound card, doesn't need to do all this complicated media stuff. It can concentrate on doing the signaling. And Stream Engine, similarly, doesn't have to know the details of the protocol you're using, doesn't have to understand SIP or XMPP, it can concentrate on doing all the RTP and not have to worry about the protocol. And the nice thing is also that you can use the exact same code with XMPP connections, Jabber connections, and also with SIP connections, and it works just the same. So in SignStream Engine, we use the Farsight library, and that has the idea of different transmitters which transmit data over the network in different ways. So for simple connections, which is sort of the classical SIP case, is that you just create raw UDP connections, and it has the raw UDP transmitter for that. And the idea is that we can create a new libnice backend, which will use libnice for doing this ICE negotiation and transmitting the data that way. But whichever transmitter you're using, it all boils down to using GStreamer. So I've been talking a lot about voice over IP and video over IP, but one of the most exciting things for doing peer-to-peer connections is using it for other applications, games or document collaboration or any other kind of thing that you might want to do. And while obviously you could, you know, send game information through the Java server, you have problems like latency, you have increased bandwidth usage, which again makes clients unhappy, and so we like to avoid this if possible. In the telepathy world, the solution you have is Tubes, which gives you an abstract connection to your contacts. So in Alice's case, she has an account on a server, and she's going to say, I want to start this game with Bob. And telepathy hides the details of how the connection with Bob is created. So if I write a program that wants to communicate with other programs on other computers, then I don't have to worry about the details of the protocol, don't have to worry about NAT traversal, I don't have to worry about accounts, ideas that I can use as an abstract interface. And whichever protocol I'm using, and it might be Java, it might be something else, TEPT will just make this stuff happen. Of course, you can do this with libnice directly, but we think TEPT makes it a bit easier. So in summary, peer-to-peer actions are good because they give you lower latency, means lower bandwidth costs. NATs are bad. Although they solve the problem of IP address allocation problems, they do create lots of problems for creating peer-to-peer connections. And ICE replaces ad hoc solutions for punching holes through networks and gives you a secure and standard way of doing it. Mandatory web address if you want to find out the project. The website is very bare, mostly because I haven't been working on it for a while, but now that we have a complete implementation, which Nokia guys have been working on, activity is kind of wrapping up again. So, any questions? Okay.
My question is, you mentioned that it sort of used fallback on Sun and some other mechanisms in
sure.
some cases. Who brokers the connection in the case in which you have to fall back on Sun for an arbitrary connection between two loads?
So, whenever you're doing a ICE negotiation, one party is the controlling agent, one party is the passive agent. So both parties will start off by, so I'll say to you, okay, I want to call you, and you'll say, okay, I want to accept this call. So as soon as you say you want to accept this call, you start generating candidates. So you look at all your network interfaces, and you have your set of network interfaces. And each of these interfaces, you'll try and talk to a Stun server to find out if that interface has actually got an internet connection that's behind the NAT.
But which Stun server do you end up using?
You have to always start off with Stun server. So either you have it hard-coded in your client, or, for example, for Jabber, you might, when you connect to your Jabber server, you might say, can you suggest a Stun server for me to use? It doesn't really matter which Stun server you use. They're all interchangeable, although, obviously, if I set up a Stun server and everybody starts using it, then that's suboptimal. So people tend to run their own Stun servers, and it's part of the configuration of how you use your account. ICE deployment hasn't really isn't really widespread with SIP yet. People are starting to implement it, but in theory, when you create your SIP connection, so if you're a VoIP provider and you do you map VoIP to the public telephone network, then when I get an account from you, you send me a configuration which includes that Stun server. Did that answer your question? Or okay, great. Hey.
Do you know of any development roadmaps on any well-known projects now known to be using ICE?
People have been pretty quiet about it. I mean, they sort of look at the mailing list sporadically, and apart from libnice, I know about one other.
Let me rephrase my question.
Sure.
Do you know of any well-known projects that are using libnice in their application now?
Oh, right.
Planning to.
Well, the only one I know of is TEPT, and that's so. So TEPT itself doesn't really care about. Whether the stream engine is using libnice or not, but I've made a preliminary backend for Farsight, which sort of works. So I've got a proof of concept, and if with some more development, then we'll switch to using that for default for making voice over IP calls using Java, using any TEPT protocol that supports ICE. apart from that, if anybody's using our code, then they haven't told us.
Okay, thanks.
Can you repeat any questions?
Oh, sure, right. Is there any, sorry?
Once a connection is made,
yeah.
Is there any overhead?
There is, yeah. So the question is, once you make a connection with ICE, is there any overhead to that connection? Once you've made the connection, you then interleave the media that you're sending, so usually RTP, and the connectivity checks. So maybe once every, I'm not sure what the default is, but I think maybe 50 milliseconds, you, instead of an RTP packet, you insert a connectivity check. So this is maybe a few dozen bytes so that you can detect if the connection goes down or if, generally if the connection goes down or if the internet connection has changed in any way. So it's a small overhead, I think. I think it's, I'm not sure exactly what that is, but I think mm-hmm. I think it's pretty small.
Hi. Yeah, I noticed on the website it says that ICE protects security against some attacks.
Like yeah.
It's interesting what attacks it doesn't, like things like replay attacks, spam attacks.
I don't know. I'm not sure what I was thinking of when I wrote that. I mean, replay attacks you should protect against because you're always generating a new authentication each time. So you can't reuse old authentication if you've captured it. If there are attacks which aren't covered, I expect them to be covered in the security section of the RFC draft. So there should be a link to the draft on the website. It might be a link to an old draft. The current draft is draft 19, but that draft, if you go to tools.ietf.org/mmusic, that has a link to the draft from there in nice HTML form, and that covers all the different attacks that they thought of. So if there's an attack they thought of and it doesn't cover it, then it should be listed in there. Great. Thanks.